this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier.
Pleased to welcome back to our guest line Eric John Phelps, the author of Vatican Assassins, a new and revised and expanded edition of which will be available shortly, and we'll ask him about that in a few moments. But first and foremost, we extend our welcome. Brother Eric, thanks for returning to PID Radio.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Dirk, and your listeners.
We have been doing a series over the last month or so focusing on conspiracies, and there is no more prominent a conspiracy in the history of the United States, if not the world, than the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Your research into that event takes a very different perspective from those of other researchers, and we wanted to get your take on it because we are impressed, first of all, that it's a fresh look on the day, but also because it is so meticulously researched. In a nutshell, can you give us an overview? And I guess the big question would be, who do you see, based on the evidence you've researched, as being responsible for the death of President Kennedy?
The ones that I blame for being behind the assassination of John F. Kennedy are the Jesuits, subject to their general, who at that time was Jean Baptiste Janssens. And the Jesuits then are in command or in control of the Roman hierarchy, which the most powerful churchman at the time in 1963 was the Archbishop of New York, Francis Cardinal Spellman, who in turn was the protector of the American lands or the American branch of the Sovereign Military Order of Malta. And these Knights of Malta of his were in key positions of power at the time of the assassination, so that it can be proven that through them that indeed the Vatican was behind the murder of President Kennedy.
Well, the most obvious question, I think, following from that statement is, why would the Vatican take out the first Roman Catholic president in American history?
Because he was disobedient. He resisted the papacy, he resisted the Jesuits, he resisted the Knights of Malta, he resisted their Cold War. I have a list of things that he did that was absolutely forbidden, and therefore justified this piece of business or executive action called his murder.
Okay, so let's look at the events of the day then. In what way would the hand of the Jesuits have worked in Dallas on that day?
Okay, we'll go back a few years.
Okay.
After, of course, the Knights of Malta were the ones who brought on World War II. They controlled FDR. Patrick Cardinal Hayes put FDR in office in 1932. He used certain Knights of Malta to do it. One of them was Joseph Kennedy, and also another one was Mr. Brady, whose wife Genevieve was a dame of Malta, Nicholas Brady. Nicholas Brady was the head of over 100 corporations at the time, and much wealthier than the Rockefellers. So the Knights of Malta brought on World War II, backing FDR, backing Hitler, backing Mussolini, secretly backing Stalin, and backing Churchill. And so they controlled all the factions of World War II, and they orchestrated them together for the purposes that they wanted to accomplish. After World War II, they then inaugurated the Cold War. So the Knights of Malta are the great Cold Warriors. They had much to accomplish in that time, one of the things being the continual dismemberment of the British Empire, which was historically Protestant. So they were continuing their Cold War, which was a hoax, controlling both sides, of course, weakening the U.S. while building Russia and China. And as they continued this Cold War, Kennedy came along and wanted to end it. One of the things that he wanted to do was end Cardinal Spellman's war in Vietnam. That's called Spelly's War. Another thing he wanted to do is he wanted to prevent the Pope's Masonic Jewish Labor Zionist government of Israel from acquiring a nuclear weapon. This was absolutely forbidden because, remember, the Jesuits want to have what they considered to be the medieval or the Dark Age Kingdom of Jerusalem secured so that they can rebuild the Third Hebrew Temple for ultimately a pope of their making. To do that, they have to have weapons supremacy there in Israel, and Kennedy wanted to prevent that. Another reason is that Kennedy crossed the Jesuit Order's Federal Reserve Bank. Of course, the Federal Reserve Bank, the Class A stockholders like Citibank and J.P. Morgan, Chase Manhattan, were all run by Knights of Malta, Martin of Shea, and others. So Kennedy printed $4.3 billion in United States notes, outraging the Knights because he didn't use Federal Reserve notes that are collect interest from we who passed them around. Kennedy also wanted to, in the stopping of the Vietnam War, that would have cut the partnership between the CIA and the Mafia in their drug trade to bring out their drugs out of the Golden Triangle. And remember that the Mafia and the OSS had a relationship throughout World War II in Operation Underworld, whereby Spellman used the Mafia dons of New York, particularly Luciano, to supposedly secure the invasion of Sicily. So we've had an ongoing relationship between the CIA and the Mafia, and Albert Vincent Corona was CIA, he was Army Intel, and he was part of the Gambino family. And I still maintain that Carlo Gambino was a high-level man in Malta, along with John McCone at the time of the Kennedy assassination. So we have high-level Knights involved in the Mafia, the CIA, and if the Vietnam War would have ended, the drug trade as we know it today, this tremendously lucrative drug trade for the papacy while destroying the major cities of the United States would have ended.
So the Vatican, through the Jesuits, were actually benefiting from that drug trade from Southeast Asia?
Absolutely. And it's their drug trade. They ran the whole opium, all the opium wars in the 19th century using the British. Because remember, the British century was that century by which they used the British to overthrow the Manchu dynasty and a series of other things. And that drug trade, that opium trade, was completely in the hands of the Black Pope through the English branch of the Knights of Malta and high-level Freemasonry.
So you've got John F. Kennedy then, who was looking to put a stop to the war in Vietnam and the drug trade running from that part of the world, prevent Israel from acquiring nuclear weapons, and severing America's relationship with the Federal, or dependence on the Federal Reserve Bank.
That's right. The other thing was he wanted to cut the tax breaks for the big oil men. So that brings in Murchison and Hunt. He was going to get rid of those tax breaks. And I maintain that those Texas oilmen, those billionaires, were also connected to the Vatican by knighthoods. And so therefore, because the Vatican runs the whole oil industry, George Herbert Walker Bush is probably one of the most powerful knights of Malta in the world. He is a kingpin in the Pope's international oil bonanza. Of course, the papacy set up Saudi Arabia in 1932 with King Ibn Saud using Benito Mussolini, whose advisor was Pietro Tachi Venturi, the secretary of the Society of Jesus. So the Jesuits control not only the drug trade, they control the international oil market. So, and Kennedy wanted to cut that.
George H.W. Bush is a Knight of Malta?
That's right, and so was his brother, Prescott Bush Jr., and so was his father, Prescott Bush Sr., and Prescott Bush Sr. was a partner with one of Germany's most powerful Knights of Malta and fanatical Roman Catholics, Fritz Thiessen. Fritz Thiessen purchased the Brown House for Adolf Hitler. Without Fritz Thiessen, there is no Adolf Hitler. Without Franz von Papen, that Knight of Malta, there is no Adolf Hitler. And Michael Cardinal von Faulhaber, who was the Archbishop of Munich, was also a Knight of Malta. And without Faulhaber, there is no Hitler.
Now, I'm going to ask a question that may be rather naive and may demonstrate a real lack of understanding of the way this thing works. But don't you have to be Roman Catholic to be a Knight of Malta?
No. Henry Luce was a Presbyterian. He was a Knight of Malta. He was a most notorious Knight of Malta, right across the street in St. Patrick's Cathedral, where he was residing in Rockefeller Center, and Luce controlled the press. You don't have to be Catholic to be a Knight of Malta. There are those knights who are ancient nobility Catholics, like J. Peter Grace and Andrew Bertie and others, but they do admit others into the order who are not Catholic. They've admitted certain Jews into the order, one of them being Major Lewis M. Bloomfield, who Jim Garrison wanted to investigate, question, but he was not allowed to. And Bloomfield was tied to big industry in Israel. He's a Jew, and yet he's a Knight of Malta, affiliated and a director on CMC, the Senio Mondial Comercial, which is also involved with Terminix. So you don't have to be Catholic necessarily. That is a very key thing.
Okay, so the Knights of Malta are more, obviously, than just a social fraternity. What,
right.
What is their purpose, then?
Their purpose, of course, their purpose is to restore the temple power of the Pope around the world, that the Pope will rule all the governments of the world, all the banks, all the parties, academia, medicine, law, everything that's necessary to maintain the temporal power, the political power of the Pope. And if you remember, the Pope has the two keys. It's a clandestine skull and crossbones. If you look at the papal flag, you have the triple crown and you have two keys. It's clandestine skull and crossbones. And the two keys symbolize the spiritual power of the Pope, that every individual in the world must be subject to his spiritual power, and that there's no salvation outside the Catholic Church. And the second power is his temple power, that every nation, every king, every president must be one of his altar boys, that they must submit to his political will. And the nation that does not do that comes under the attack of the papacy. A president who will not do that will come under the attack of the Knights and the Jesuits. This was the case with Kennedy.
How long have the Knights of Malta been around?
They've been around since the 11th century. They were one of the first order created for the purpose of the Crusades to take Jerusalem, quote-unquote, from the infidel Muslims. And they then, after Jerusalem was taken on the first crusade, they then became the protectors for all the pilgrims who would come to Jerusalem. And they became the great merchants of the earth. They were the ones whose navy would war with the Muslim navy. They were the military men, because it's called the Sovereign Military Order of Malta. They were first known as the Hospitallers and the Knights of Rhodes, and then finally the Knights of Malta. But that was their early beginning.
Okay, so they were founded about the same time as the Knights Templar.
That's right. The Knights Templars were founded after them, shortly after.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So the Knights Templars are the high-level Masons of today. The Hospitallers, the Knights Hospitallers, are the Knights of Malta today, and they work together.
Hmm. Okay. So how was the organization set up then in 1962 and the group that plotted against John F. Kennedy?
Okay, I'll go back a little bit.
All right.
The Knights of Malta were made subject to the Jesuits as a result of the Napoleonic Wars.
Okay.
This is important. The Jesuits had been expelled from Malta in 1768. So when they caused the French Revolution and brought Napoleon to power out of Corsica, they used Napoleon with his navy to take Malta back, take Malta and take all the treasures and weapons so they could conduct a crusade into the Middle East, and they drove the Knights of Malta into the court of Russia. And from the time that they were in the court of Russia to 1917, they were the real power in Russia, and they were expelled openly by Lenin in 1917. So the Knights of Malta were made subject to the Jesuit order in about 1800 when they were driven to Russia, and the Jesuit general was resident in Russia at that time because the Jesuits had been suppressed by the popes, Bull Dominic Aqueduct Noster, in 1773. So the Knights are now, at that time, subject to the Jesuits, and they will do their bidding, and they have done their bidding. So now when we come to the Kennedy assassination, as we see the Knights of Malta, they now are subject to the Jesuits, as the Jesuits control the Roman hierarchy, and the Roman hierarchy controls the Knights of Malta. So as the head of the Knights of Malta in the U.S. at the time was Spellman, he then controlled the Knights of Malta, but he was under the advice of the Jesuits from Georgetown University.
Okay, so the Jesuits of Georgetown controlled or advised Archbishop Spellman in New York.
That's correct, and also the Jesuits from Fordham.
Okay.
Jesuits from Fordham and Georgetown.
Okay, so then was Cardinal Spellman involved in the operational planning for this, or did he just make it known that this is something that needed to be done and then let others take the ball and run with it as far as how it would be carried out?
Cardinal Spellman was the one who gave the order to his J. Peter Grace, J. Peter Grace was the head of the Knights of Malta in 1963. J. Peter Grace was the one who brought in many, many Nazis into the U.S. and hired several of them for his firm, W.R. Grace. And so Grace then handed it to his subordinate knights, like John McCone, Alan Dulles, who was another Knight of Malta.
Really?
And not a Catholic, by the way. And so we have the heads of the CIA usually always being Knights of Malta, from Wild Bill Donovan to Dulles to John McCone. And so there they then orchestrated, and the most powerful Knight of Malta in the FBI at the time was the assistant to J. Edgar Hoover, Carter DeLoach. So Carter DeLoach, he was in charge of the FBI as far as suppressing evidence and not kind of confiscating the pictures that were taken in Dealey Plaza.
Okay, so Grace then was given the order by Spellman to go ahead and conduct this hit. Who would Grace have turned to then for operations?
He would turn to the head of the Knights of Malta, the head of the CIA, Alan Dulles, who was really the head, even though he was relieved by Kennedy for the Bay of Pigs, deliberate loss of the Bay of Pigs that Kennedy was not responsible for. See, Kennedy did not give the order to cancel the Ear Cupper. According to Fletcher Prouty in his work, JFK, it was McGeorge Bundy who did that. And McGeorge Bundy was Skull and Bones, CFR, and therefore he betrayed Kennedy. So Kennedy is very much embarrassed, so he relieves Dulles of his command. He relieves Charles Cabell of his command as assistant to deputy director of CIA. And so now Kennedy reappoints John McCone as the head of the CIA, but McCone's first loyalty is to the Archbishop. It's not to Kennedy, because McCone is a Knight of Malta. He was formerly the head of the Atomic Energy Commission. He's a very great man of power. And so McCone is going to be subordinate to his commander, J. Peter Grace, and then he also has other Knights of Malta in the CIA, like James Angleton. And James Angleton was awarded one of the highest awards that could ever be given by the Knights of Malta for his protection of the Black Prince of Italy, who was a Borghese.
Oh, really? I did not know they were still around.
Oh, yes. Remember, the nobility still rules. The nobility of the Dark Age now rules the nations, but they rule them through these facades called democracies. Or republics. They're not really true democratic republics, but they call them republics or democracies. They control all the political leaders through the parties they control, and because they control all the money. And so the knights, the princes of the blood of Europe and America, they rule. And so Angleton was a part of this. Borghese was a part of this. Bloomfield was a part of this as a Knight of Malta. And so was Clay Shaw, the head of the trademark in New Orleans. So
he was a Knight of Malta also.
Clay Shaw was CIA, a Knight of Malta, Roman Catholic, had a trademark in New Orleans. And he was a co-director of CMC in Italy and involved with Permanex also. And some of the princes that were involved, the Knights of Malta involved with CMC, are Prince Gutierrez di Spadafora, an Italian industrialist and a large landowner. His daughter-in-law was related to Hymar Schock. Schock's son-in-law was Otto Scorsini was a Knight of Malta.
He was he?
He was, yes, he was.
He was the one
who helped Bormann rebuild the Reich out of South America, and Bormann was protected by a Knight of Malta named Juan Perón.
Eric, how did they coordinate events in Dallas? Were there Jesuits on the ground in Dallas, or did they delegate responsibility and authority for the actual operations to CIA, Mafia, Special Forces? Who handled the actual groundwork in Dallas?
Okay, the Jesuits always use third parties now. They don't personally carry out assassinations. And that's the purpose for the intelligence communities and the Mafia that they've created. So they always keep an arm's length away from these crimes. They used to do it themselves, but since the revival and since really the turn of the 20th century, they have their third trusted, they call it, Ignatius Loyola called it in his secret instructions, a trusted third party. Mm-hmm. So they always use a trusted third party. So, for example, in Dallas, we know that the night before the, this was all worked out months in advance. Alan Dulles was one of the planners of it, of the CIA. Gerald Ford was, I'm sure, involved. He's also a Knight of Malta, high-level 33rd degree Freemason. John McCloy was involved. McCloy was a very key individual. McCloy was the one who released at least 28 high-level Nazi murderers out of prison after the Nuremberg trials by 1951. Jean McCloy was very much involved. Hoover was involved. Hoover hated the Kennedys. In fact, Hoover was going to be relieved of his command by John F. Kennedy. Johnson was involved. Johnson was not going to be a running mate for Kennedy for 1964. Carlos Marcello and Joseph Civello were involved. They're the Mafia Don, Civello the Mafia Don of Dallas, and Marcello the Mafia Don of New Orleans. They were involved because Marcello had been deported to Guatemala for 24 hours. He was enraged over Robert Kennedy, and so he was very much incited for the killing of JFK. So all these men of power, Earl Cabell, whose brother, Charles Cabell, had been relieved of his command of assistant director to the CIA. He happens to be the mayor of Dallas.
Oh, right, right.
Yeah, so Earl Cabell is, since he's the mayor of Dallas, he's going to be in control of the police chief of Dallas, Jesse Curry. He's also going to be in control of the DA, Henry Wade. And also the Texas Rangers are involved. You have the Dallas, you have the sheriff of the county, the Dallas-Fort Worth County there, Sheriff Peoples, he's involved. And it's quite intriguing that all of these men that I just mentioned to you, including Murchison, Hunt, Richard Nixon, were all at the secret meeting at Clint Murchison's mansion in Dallas on November 21st in 1963, according to Madeline Duncan Brown, President Johnson's Roman Catholic mistress for 21 years, who bore him a son named Stephen, and she wrote a book called Texas in the Morning. And of course, this is also validated by Robert D. Morrill in his book Firsthand Knowledge, How I Participated in the CIA Mafia Murder of President Kennedy. And this is validated on page 195 in a note, and he says, note 12, it was from his good friend Hoover that Richard Nixon learned of the pending assassination. Interestingly, on the eve of the assassination, Hoover and Nixon attended a meeting together at the Dallas home of oil baron Clint Murchison. Among the subjects discussed at this meeting were the political futures of Hoover and Nixon in the event President Kennedy was assassinated. Hmm. Well, that's where they made their final plans. And according to Madeline Duncan Brown, when Johnson came out of the meeting, he said, that SOB will never embarrass me again. So they had it all planned the night before and knowing exactly what they were going to do. And there, according to my list of the Who Are the Knights of Malta by Martin Lee, there are at least 8 Knights of Malta who are residents in Dallas. And, of course, George de Morenschild was also a Knight of Malta. His brother Dmitri was a Knight of Malta. The de Morenschilds were Russian nobles openly driven from Russia by Lenin at the time of the Bolshevik Revolution, so that it would appear to be that the revolution was really anti-noble, anti-aristocracy, when in fact this was a ruse to make the Russian Revolution look like it was completely Masonic and completely Jewish. Now, so George de Morenschild is a knight.
Now, as we discussed with Peter Lavenda some months ago, there was a connection, sort of a tangential connection between de Morenschild and the patsy, the guy who was accused of shooting, and why shouldn't I?
Oswald,
Lee Harvey Oswald. Uh-huh. It's amazing that I can discuss this and forget his name. But interestingly enough, that would get too far off track. But very very bizarre that de Morenschild had some contact with Oswald prior to the events of November 22nd of 63.
We know it's only odd unless we know who Oswald really is. See, Oswald, according to Deputy Sheriff Roger Craig, was an FBI informant.
Really?
Yes, and you can find this on one of Mark Lane's video. He has Two Men in Dallas. So Oswald was an FBI informant. That's why he was conversing with Hoste. Oswald was FBI. Yeah, and remember at this meeting with George, at Murchison's house, there's another guy that's there, and his name is Jack Ruby.
Okay.
Jack Ruby's not only mob, he's also an FBI informant.
Ruby was at that meeting at Murchison's?
Yes.
Oh.
And he was also an FBI informant. So you have mafia FBI tied in the person of Jack Ruby. Another thing about DeMarcio, or about FBI or Oswald DeMarcio, of course, they both speak Russian.
Mm-hmm.
And Oswald is also a CIA operative.
Right.
Because he was not a real defector.
Mm-hmm.
And he married a woman whose uncle was a KGB officer.
Right.
So they, after Oswald, they're setting Oswald up to be this patsy, so they have to paint him with the brush of a fanatic and make him look like he's a communist and a Russian and Soviet. And so that was the purpose of him staying in Russia for, what, nearly 2 years. So he comes back. He's not even debriefed, so it shows you his CIA connection. And then and then his wife comes with him, which is virtually impossible. I mean, mm-hmm. Victor Herman couldn't get his wife out. Victor Herman had been a slave in Russia for, what, 40-something years. It's a tremendous story that you might want to run sometime. It's called Coming Out of the Ice. Victor Herman wrote a book called Coming Out of the Ice and the Gray People, showing that Henry Ford sacrificed 73 American families to Joseph Stalin, all of them killed in the gulags, except Victor Herman, this Jew who managed to escape by the grace of God. And these Americans built the whole Gorky plant. And then after they built it, they were eliminated.
Mm.
But that's neither here nor there. Victor Herman couldn't get his wife out. How could Oswald get his wife out? Because he was CIA.
That was one of the points that was really highlighted in Oliver Stone's movie JFK.
Yes.
And we'll talk about that a little bit more. I want to get your assessment of the film. But that was one of the things that stuck with me regarding Oswald. How is it that he was able, first of all, to defect, quote-unquote, but then to return with so little difficulty?
Right.
In early 1960s America, at the height of the Cold War, you would think that he would have found himself in a prison so fast if he tried to come back.
Right. Hmm. Look what happened to Yuri Nyshenko. Nyshenko came over here and he said the KGB at the time, where they were not handling Oswald. He was not a KGB agent sent back here. Nyshenko was a legitimate defector. What did Angleton do? He tortured him for, what, nearly 3 years.
Hmm.
That's what Oswald should have went through when he was in Russia. What happens? He's given the royal treatment.
Mm-hmm.
He works in a factory in Minsk. I mean, the guy is on Easy Street. He gets married and then he comes back. No. He is... The CIA and the KGB work together. That's why the Cold War is a hoax.
Hmm.
Cold War is a creation of the press in this country, controlled by the Vatican through the Council on Foreign Relations. The Cold War never existed. There was never a real war between the Russian government and the American government. It's all a hoax. What happened was low-level men were killed, and there were wars trying to prop it up, like the Korean War and so on, that were in the Vietnam War that shows it's come out of the Cold War. But it was all a hoax. On the top, they all worked together because the Jesuits were building their international intelligence community that is now completely and totally united.
Hmm.
And this is one of the keys in understanding how Oswald got in and how he got out, because the KGB and the CIA worked together, both of them run by Knights of Malta. Knights particularly like Kim Philby, who was in a KGB general at the time. He already went to Russia. He was already shown to be a spy, so he was MI5 and he left, and then instead of being executed, he was able to go to Moscow and be a KGB agent at the time of the Kennedy assassination. And the other thing is that Anatoly Golitsyn. Anatoly Golitsyn comes from a royal Russian family all the way back to Alexander I. Golitsyn was a Knight of Malta, and he came over to the United States and was given all the secret files of the CIA by James Angleton. And he went through these files for a couple of years, and that's why all the CIA operatives in Russia were killed, because they were betrayed by Angleton. And Angleton was a Knight of Malta, and he betrayed him to his brother, Knight of Malta, Golitsyn, who then forwarded all this information to Moscow.
So all the pieces are in place in Dallas. We've got all of these powerful Knights of Malta on the ground and in positions of authority where they can direct the pawns on the chessboard.
That's right. And one other thing I forgot. Bishop of Dallas-Fort Worth
mm-hmm.
is Thomas... Kiley Gorman. Thomas Kiley Gorman is a Knight of Malta.
Okay.
So therefore, he's overseeing everything that's going on in the Dallas-Fort Worth area.
Now,
I have read, and I'm certainly not a scholar on the JFK assassination, but I've read that the security measures that should have been standard for a presidential motorcade were totally lacking in Dallas that day. The route of the motorcade, the number of security forces on the ground, just totally absent. They, in other words, they did everything wrong that could have been done wrong. Who would have been responsible for those security measures? Would that have been the Secret Service? And who would have been in a position to remove the protection from around President Kennedy?
Well, as I understand, the one responsible for the security of the president would have been military intelligence, General Lansdale, according to Fletcher Prouty in his great work, JFK. So Lansdale, who was CFR and was involved with the Nazis, he is the one who is behind removing all the protection of JFK in Dallas for that day.
Okay.
And so with that, the Secret Service are the ones that will be carrying out the assassination, because the Jesuits always carry out their assassinations up close and personal. There can be no chance of escape. So no final kill shots are going to be done with a rifle. So the Secret Service are going to do the close-up shooting. There will be long-distance CIA shooters. There will be FBI covering up evidence. There will be Dallas police further covering up evidence. There will be the sheriff covering up evidence and suppressing those in his office who would want to do something about it. So, but these are all low-level guys. The high-level guys from Washington, ultimately from New York, from the CFR. The Pentagon is controlled by the Council on Foreign Relations in New York City. The CFR controls all of our military heads, and thus, whatever order is given by the Archbishop of New York through his knights, to the Council on Foreign Relations, to the Pentagon, then that's what will be carried out in Dallas.
Okay. So the motorcade has made that fateful turn in front of the book depository. What is the sequence of events then from that point? Who does what?
Okay. The route was changed at the last minute.
Mm-hmm.
It was not supposed to take that hairpin turn. And so they turn right on Houston, and they turn left on Elm. And I tend to think whoever created... The Freddy movies on Elm Street?
Right.
That was named after the JFK assassination. So, I mean, they have their inner humor among themselves, you know, when they control Hollywood.
Okay.
So they turn on Elm, and as I understand it, there was one shot from the records building, which was a rifle shot. There was one shot from the school book depository, which, of course, Oswald did not do that. There were Cubans in that, 6-4 also. There was one shot from the Daltex building. There was one shot from the grassy knoll, from what I understand, and the next shot to Kennedy. There was one shot from the drain that William Greer pulled right up in front of.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as I believe, there was one shot from the driver, William Greer. So you have many, many different shooters. But the kill shots, you have the distractionary shots or the long-distance shots from the buildings in the background. According to a particular gentleman in a book that he wrote called, it considers the assassination for that day. He says that George Hickey fired his M16, who was a Secret Service agent, and actually accidentally shot Kennedy in the back. I don't think that was an accident. I think he did do it. You have those shooters. So what I believe happened was, is Kennedy is brought into the kill zone. You have all these distractions. And what the key parts to me are these, that the shot from the grassy knoll was a distraction. There was smoke that came out of the rifle that would cause everybody's attention to be looking at the grassy knoll.
Which is unusual because guns don't generally... gunpowder, even in the 1960s, didn't smoke.
We've had smokeless gunpowder for 100 years.
Yeah.
So there's no reason to use any kind of a shot that's going to produce smoke.
You almost have to go back to a musket to create that kind of a...
That's black powder stuff. Sure.
Right.
So, anyway, that is a very telltale sign that it was deliberate so that it would be seen to draw attention away from some other place. The other thing is, as Zapruder is filming this, and remember, Abraham Zapruder is a 32nd degree Jewish Freemason.
Really?
He's a contract agent for the CIA. Yes, he is.
Really?
Yes, sir. Zapruder was a contract agent for the CIA, and he was contracted to be there to take this film. He was being steadied by his secretary behind him, steadying his arm so that when the shots were ringing out, he wouldn't lose his focus. And so what Zapruder does is as he's taking this picture, he's using his 8mm camera, he's deliberately keeping his camera high so as not to get lowering, taking a picture of the entire broadside of the limousine, which would include the sidewalk.
Mm-hmm.
Because one of the shots is proceeding out from the drain in the curb, which the drain was approximately 18 inches high, according to two sources that I know who were there in Dallas, Penn Jones and my friend Lenny Bloom or Nelson Thummel. They were there. They walked the whole thing. And from behind the picket fence, they could walk down a concrete step underground and come to this drain, and they could stand right in this drain and have a perfect view of the limousine coming right up to them. And that's why Greer nearly stops his limousine. He's delivering the limousine up to the killer in the drain, in the storm drain. And this is exactly the position of Penn Jones, who had the Malovian mirror, and this is exactly the position of Jim Garrison at the time. That the grassy knoll shooter did not fire the kill shot. It was this drain shooter.
I've seen an examination of photographic evidence from the day using some high-tech imaging showing that's able to reveal three-dimensional imagery from the two-dimensional film that was taken of the moment of the shooting, and it was determined that based on forensics, the only angle that could have produced that kill shot was the one at least it was the one coming from a low angle, such as the drain along the side of the street there.
Yes, I'm convinced that it was a simultaneous shot from the drain and from the driver. That's what it appears to me. And I'll tell you why. For the drain, no problem. As you look at that Kennedy's head, it explodes.
Yes.
And there's actually debris going up. And then the motorcycle rider, Mr. Hargis, is splattered with blood and bone marrow, bone matter. So that he's back and to the left, and so this would betray the trajectory coming from the drain just perfectly.
Yeah, which would have been down and to the right from where President Kennedy was seated in the car.
Yep, right.
Okay.
And there was a .45 slug found, according to Deputy Sheriff Roger Craig, found in the grass on the other side of the curb in blood and brain matter.
A .45 slug?
A .45 slug, that's
which
right.
You don't fire from a rifle.
Which you don't fire from a rifle, unless you got a Thompson machine gun. That's a 45, but oh no. So that shows that there was a shot coming from the direction and low into the from the right, and that it fits perfectly to the drain. And this was Jim Garrison's position and Penn Jones's position. And so, since those men were there, I believe them. But there was no way to identify the shooter in the drain. That's why they could go with him exclusively. The other thing is, I do believe that the driver did do the shooting also, because there were several witnesses to that who simply disappeared. The cameras were confiscated, and there was blood and bone material on the back of the trunk of the limousine, which is not in agreement with a shot low and from the right.
You're right.
So,
okay.
So and according to Robert Groden, he put forth a movie once, and it showed how the bullet entered above the right eye, to the right of the right eye, and this is shown in David Lifton's work. It actually shows the bullet hole before the head was doctored at Bethesda, before it arrived at Bethesda. It shows that the actual bullet hole entry, and then the of course the big opening at the temple, but then the exit, the huge exit wound on the right rear portion of his skull, of his head. So that trajectory comes from the driver. So you have a driver shot coming that way, as William Cooper rightfully proved. He took great efforts to prove that. And also, the former head of the John Birch Society, coordinator of the John Birch Society, Dr. Stuart Crane, who taught at Bob Jones University for many years, he said the driver did it. And the other one, a Roman Catholic attorney in Washington, D.C., by the name of Dr. Peter Beter, he had a series of audio letters, and I have half of them. And one of his audio letters, he goes into this, and he says that the president was shot from inside the vehicle. Mm. So I tend to believe that the shooting was done from the driver, and this is why the driver was not blamed for all those years, because he died in 1985. William Greer died in 85, and if he was accused of that, you can know there would have been serious problems for the open accuser. So there was a simultaneous shot from the driver. This is why he turns around the very moment Kennedy's head explodes. He's looking at Kennedy in film 313 the very moment his head explodes. And I say this is why Jackie wanted to get out of the car, because she thought she's next.
Now, Eric, the Zapruder film has been around for a long time. And you do see the driver turn around. You don't see the gun clearly. It's really hard to make out from the film that driver Greer has anything in his hand.
Well, it looks like there's a reflection off Kellerman's head.
Right.
That's what it looks like. And I say that's a doctoring that was deliberately done to the film. The man who wrote Behold a Pale Horse, William Cooper, mm-hmm. went into very much effort, took a lot of effort and finance to have the Japanese analyze the film. And he said that after their analysis, that most assuredly the driver did the shooting. So I say William Cooper was the finest authority, the best digger on this issue of Greer doing the shooting. And he said that he saw private records from Navy intelligence that Greer did in fact do the shooting. And remember, Greer is a former Navy SEAL. He's okay. A crack shot.
But of course, at that distance, he would
only 5 to 6 feet away. It's point blank, and this is my point: the Jesuits always do their killing whenever it involves the poison, the leaden bullet, at close point blank range.
So now, how would the Zapruder film have been doctored?
Who would do this? Well, very intriguingly, the film was purchased. I understand there were three films that were made. Two were given to the Secret Service. One was retained by Abraham Zapruder. The films were purchased by Henry Luce of Time Life, and he paid $150,000 for the film that he got.
Who, as you mentioned, was a Knight of Malta.
And he was a Knight of Malta. Now we see the cover-up beginning with the Knights of Malta. Of course, there's the cover-up when the telephones go out in Washington for an hour. That's accomplished by the Knights of Malta through Francis Flanagan, who was the head of AT&T at the time.
Hmm.
Right. So the Knights of Malta are maintaining the cover-up, because greater is the power to maintain the cover-up than to carry out the assassination. So Henry Luce, head of Time and Life, purchases the Zapruder film for $150,000. And remember Luce is the head of Rockefeller Center.
Mm-hmm.
Rockefeller Center is across the street from St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, he's a hop, skip, and a jump away from Archbishop Spellman. And so they are suppressing this film, and so they doctor the film, and they cut certain particular frames out of the film, and they want to make it look like he was shot from behind. They did all kinds of cutting on the film, which was a crime. So it was Luce, and of course he's affiliated with the CIA. So it's the CIA that's busy doctoring these films, these frames. But fortunately, William Cooper got an original copy, and he had it analyzed, and shows absolutely the driver did the shooting. Another interesting thing is that in the JFK film with Oliver Stone, who is also a Jesuit temple coadjutor, that in the Oliver Stone film, in the JFK film, they leave out the driver when they focus in on the shooting.
Good point.
Why did they cut out the driver?
That's a good point. I hadn't noticed that.
They cut out the driver in the shooting, that's right, because he did the shooting. The other thing is,
the purpose of the movie then, which presents an awful lot of information that is, that jives with what you're saying here, but the purpose of that film then would be what?
To create unrest in the country, to move the white middle class to revolution.
Hmm.
Because to have a successful revolution, you must include the middle class. And so what the Jesuits are doing is they are driving the historic white Protestants and the white Roman Catholics into a right-wing fascist faction to ultimately then gain control of the government and do exactly in America what they did in Germany. That's why they get it. No answers. The other thing is, Oliver Stone, just like Mark Lane, that coadjutor, that Jesuit coadjutor, Jewish Jesuit coadjutor, removes all attention away from the storm drain, which a killing shot did come from, to the grassy knoll. And this was in violation of all the investigation that, that Garrison had discovered. Now, Jim Garrison was an honest man. He was there. He had agents in Dallas trying to find out what went on. One of those agents was Roger Craig, the deputy sheriff, who later was shot with a rifle after he was run off the road, got a broken back, and a series of other things happened to him where they wanted to kill him. But it was Roger Craig that said they found a Mauser on the sixth floor depository. It was not a Mannlicher Gargano. It was a Mauser, and it was a .45 slug that they found on the other side of the curve. Those two things right there completely do away with any case against Lee Harvey Oswald.
Absolutely.
There is no case. And so Garrison knew there was no case against Oswald. That's why they eliminated Oswald using FBI informant Ruby so that they wouldn't have a trial or anything like that. So Garrison found out all these details and ultimately leads to Knight of Malta, Clay Shaw. That's why. So we have coadjutor Oliver Stone, who then repaves the road in Dallas for his movie, and he further covers up the drain. The storm drain. He makes it smaller than what it was.
I did not know that.
Yes. So they're busy suppressing evidence of the shot from the storm drain and the shot from the driver, which I believe was simultaneous, hit Kennedy at the same time. That's why he had his head exploding, flesh going one direction up and one direction back over to the left, one direction back to the on the trunk of the limousine. There's two kill shots that are involved here. One from the driver, one from the dream. So this is deliberately covered up by all the cover-up nights involved in the investigation.
Now, let's go back to Abraham Zapruder. You talked about cameras being confiscated from witnesses along the route. Why would the government have allowed, the investigators have allowed Zapruder's film to, you know, why would they have let him keep a copy?
Very good question. Very good. Why would they let him keep his film? Why would they even let him stand there and film this when they were running people off the grassy knoll and other places? Why would they let him stand there? Because he was a contract agent for the CIA. They wanted this film. And you can know that the original film they have parties up in Rockefeller Center, and they invite their friends up and say, let's watch Kennedy get his head blown off as they're passing around the drinks. How dare he interfere with the temporal power of the Pope?
You know, it's interesting you mention that, because there's a book that's available on the Internet. Actually, it was a rough draft of a manuscript called The Last Circle by Sherry Seymour. And she mentioned a meeting with a gentleman on the West Coast whose name is escaping me at the moment. I'll probably think of it as soon as we stop the interview, who showed her what he claimed to be the unedited original version of the Zapruder film, which showed clearly what you describe, the driver turning and firing that kill shot. I read that for the first time just a couple of months ago, and that was my first, and I've said before on this program, I'm coming late to the party with a lot of these things. That was my first exposure to the idea that the driver had actually been the one to pull the trigger. So,
well, thank
it's
you
interesting
for that reference, though.
Oh, yeah, I'll send you a link to that after the program, because the text of her her manuscript is which doesn't deal with the JFK assassination. This is just something that she mentioned in passing in meeting with this fellow who is a CIA operative and involved in some other nefarious deeds. But the point was that you could very likely assure the cooperation of anyone in a position of government authority, especially, say, a newly elected president, by inviting him to such a meeting and showing him such a film to make the point, play ball.
That's right. There has never been a disobedient president except Nixon from that time, and Nixon had too much stuff on him because he was part of the assassination, so they just railroaded him out. But there has not been a disobedient president really since. They all know. And it's that way, really. It's been that way in Russia. There hasn't been a disobedient premier there. So they have, this was a demonstration to the world that if you mess with us, we're going to kill you in broad daylight, and we're going to get away from it, with it in the supposedly freest country in the world with the freedom of the press. It's quite an intimidating film when they show that.
Mm-hmm. So the purpose then of the Zapruder film was to hide it in plain sight. Here we've got this film that's been turned over to Time Warner, and of course you can trust Time Magazine, a reputable journal of news and information, and as we examine the film, we don't see anything except what they want us to see.
That's right. That's exactly right. And remember, the American people did not see the film until it was subpoenaed by Jim Garrison in 1969. It was locked up in Time Life for 5 years in a safe. So we owe much to Jim Garrison and his research that he did for us, and he has provided the evidence that there would be a successful reinvestigation and proving that the Knights of Malta, the Vatican, Archbishop of New York did this enough to expel the entire Roman hierarchy and the Jesuit order and the Knights of Malta out of this country. And that's what they don't want. That's why the Jesuits run the Department of Justice. That's why they had men like Patrick Fitzgerald to rat hole and to suppress investigations like the 1993 World Trade City bombing and like Bush's advisor, Karl Rove. He's a free man now thanks to Patrick Fitzgerald, that Jesuit coadjutor.
Mm-hmm.
So they control the Justice Department, they control the FBI, and they will make sure that there will never be a successful investigation of their assassinations or of their crimes.
Speaking of that now, in the months and years that followed the assassination of John F. Kennedy, a number of key witnesses and pieces of evidence disappeared. Can you summarize that for us?
Well, there were, 18 material witnesses, something along that line, who died strangely within, 3 years after the assassination. This can be seen in a movie called Executive Action. It was put out in 1973. Supposedly George de Morrisfield had a hand in this production.
Executive Action, was that a movie with...
Burt Lancaster.
Okay.
And you know the actor that they used to portray the man responsible for the assassination? The actor that they used, he was an older gentleman who appeared to be the one who would give the final command for the killing of Kennedy. His name was Will Greer.
That's right.
Will Greer.
Yeah.
It's an innuendo.
Grandpa Walton.
It's an innuendo to show that the real assassin was William Greer. That's why they chose the actor Will Greer to play the part of, it's Mr. Thomason or something.
How interesting.
Mm-hmm.
It was Will Greer was his name.
Greer.
I'm looking at the Internet Movie Database right now. Will Greer with
Gear.
No R.
Is it Greer?
Yeah, G-E-E-R. Okay. Played the role of Ferguson in the movie, but
Ferguson. That's right. Ferguson. Mm-hmm.
Which is interesting. Ferguson happens to be my lovely wife's maiden name. So, but I assure you, we had nothing to do with anything we're discussing today. But still, that is awfully close and perhaps a sideways reference to what had been done in Dallas on that day. And it is, we certainly believe, and there may be listeners who would disagree or think that we're stretching a point here, but we certainly believe that Hollywood is used and the entertainment industry is used to plant thoughts, memes, guide public discourse even, and to important public events through the way they're portrayed in film. I mean, that's the reason that there's such a hoo-ha about the Da Vinci Code. It appears, when you watch Oliver Stone's film, JFK, that you're seeing a bold examination of the events in Dealey Plaza that day. But as you point out, what you're actually seeing is a very clever deception that de-emphasizes the role of William Greer and whoever was in the storm drain.
Yeah, and William Greer, that's right.
Yeah.
William Greer and the driver and whoever's in the storm drain. Some people said it was Johnny Roselli in the storm drain, but it doesn't really matter. The people that de-emphasizes that, it puts all your attention on the grassy knoll, and then from there, You know, who knows? But they don't want to begin to look at the other facts, like when Garrison sought to subpoena Alan Dulles, they would not deliver the subpoena. It would not be delivered for him to come. So he is this Alan Dulles, a Knight of Malta, who is whose nephew, by the way, today is a Knight of Malta and a cardinal and a Jesuit by the name of Avery Dulles, who lives and works at Fordham University. So that they are not going to be allowed to do this. Jim Garrison also wanted to interview Major Lewis Mortimer Bloomfield, a veteran of the OSS who resided in Montreal. He could not be interviewed because this guy is one of the 11 directors in a company in Montreal that's actually based in Rome, and he is also involved with the World Trade Center, the Centro Mundial Comercial, whose sole purpose is that, quote, for Rome will recover once again her position as center of the civilized world. And that's an article of May Brussel, the Nazi connection to the JFK assassination. So yes, these very key men were not allowed to be subpoenaed and come to trial. And for Garrison to actually serve Clay Shaw and get him into the court, my, that was a miracle that he actually was able to pull that off. He had a Knight of Malta in there. He had a highest clearance in the CIA in there. He's former OSS. He's a friend of Borghese and all the knights in Italy. He, in his private phone book, he has the knights of a number of several knights, and he's also involved in human sacrifice, as Garrison discovered when he was looking at his place in New Orleans, and we have that on page 169 of Garrison's book. I wouldn't say human sacrifice, but some sort of torture with blood involved on page 169. And I'll read that for you. It says, probably the most interesting single item seized in the course of Shaw's arrest was his address book. It offered some insight into the proclivity of developing casual relationships at lofty levels of European aristocracy. How many Americans have in their address books such fascinating names and addresses as the Marquis Giuseppe Ray Vincina in Italy, or the Baron Raphael de Bainfield, Villa Tripkovich of Teresa, Italy, Sir Stephen Runciman, well, he was the Archbishop of Canterbury, Princess Jacqueline Chimay, Lady Margaret d'Arcy, and a few other things. And then he goes on to say, and also found by our investigators at Shaw's luxurious appointed carriage house in the French Quarter were a few more novel items, including five whips, several lengths of chain, and a black hood matching black cape. The whips had on them what happened to be dried blood. In the bedroom, about 2.5 feet apart, two large hooks had been screwed into the ceiling. These accoutrements hardly were inculpatory in themselves. Different people have different hobbies. Had Shaw lived in an earlier era, however, the list of nobles in his address book might have included the Marquis de Sade.
Yeah, he was a very bizarre character. He was the guy, if you've seen the movie JFK, he was the character portrayed by Tommy Lee Jones in the movie. And there are a couple of scenes in there that are a little over the top, but would seem to be borne out by the evidence from Clay Shaw's apartment. We're almost out of time, Brother Eric, and it's gone by far too quickly. If you could summarize, what do you see as the effect on America of the assassination of John F. Kennedy?
The effect of America on America is this. It was not solved as it should have been, with the blame being put on the Pope of Rome and his Jesuits. Therefore, they have greatly increased their power. They are now in complete control of this government, and they brought down not the World Trade Center. They caused 9/11 through Knight of Malta, George J. Tenet. They've now got a papal crusade against the Muslim peoples, and it's not going to end, according to Newt Gingrich, between 30 and 50 years. This is a papal crusade, and they are most seriously about implementing Nazi fascism in this country, and we are in serious trouble because the Kennedy assassination was not solved.
Life is short, pray hard, as they say.
Thank you for having me, Derek and Sharon. I appreciate you having me on, and thank you for all your listeners listening in.
Well, God bless you. We appreciate your time. Thank you again for being on PID Radio.
Okay.
Cutting-edge news and analysis on demand.
This is PID Radio.